I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 26th of August. Monday at 1 means all things political. And our guest this hour is Jeffrey Lord. Jeffrey is a contributing editor to the American Spectator, a former aide to Ronald Reagan and Jack Kemp. We'll start with Syria. U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel saying today that the administration is studying intelligence on Syria's possible use of chemical weapons. He spoke with reporters and said that we are analyzing the intelligence and we will get the facts. And if there is any action taken, it will be in concert with the international community and within the framework of a legal justification. What options are being considered and should be considered? We'll be talking about that in other international news. We've been spending a lot of time on Egypt, and we'll ask whether or not America should stand up in some way to the generals in Egypt. Jeffrey's written some interesting pieces recently on Republican Party leaders doing battle with the party's base over immigration. He called for an end to dual citizenship on this week, where we will mark the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. Lots of people in Washington, D.C. on Saturday. Lots of speakers were there. We'll talk about what some of them had to say. And whether or not, as Colin Powell has suggested over the weekend, the president needs to speak more on issues of race. We'll welcome phone calls from you, as we always do, for our programs. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org, and you can always leave messages for us on our Facebook page, and that is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Jeffrey Lord, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Kathleen. I hate to say this, but summer is almost over.
No,
bad.
Don't say that. I get depressed. I see a few leaves changing, and I think, not only
changing here, they're falling already. It's depressing.
I know, it is depressing. Well, get all the swims in you can this week. That's my motto of the week. Go swimming.
Right.
Absolutely. Well, let's start with Syria, which, of course, is the big news of the day, and whether or not chemical weapons have been used and who may have used those. What do you think about this? Do you think there is pretty strong evidence that they have been used? And do you think a plan should be followed by the United States, or are things pretty much up in the air and we have a lot of facts to gather?
Well, I think they've been used. I mean, one can only look at these pictures.
Oh, they're awful, aren't they? Oh,
they're just horrifying.
Yes, they are.
And I think absolutely we should be doing something. I would hope certainly that we have a plan. You know, this gets to a disagreement, I think, between not only President Obama and conservatives, but among some conservatives themselves, as to the role of the United States in the world. And as a former Reagan aide, I remember, you know, very vividly that he went against the grain at the time and talked about peace through strength and this kind of thing. And he was accused by former President Ford, among others, of being a sentimentalist and, you know, out of touch with reality. The United States' day, America's day, had sort of come and gone in terms of the way it had been right after World War II. President Reagan didn't accept any of that, and I, you know, went on to sort of guide us back to a position where we were able to win the Cold War. At this point, I think we have disagreements, as I say, not only with President Obama, but with people within the conservative movement, you know, the sort of Ron Paul followers, as to what is the role of the United States in the world. I, for one, think that what's happening in Syria is inevitable when there's a vacuum of leadership, that they feel that any bully, as it were, feels free to go ahead and do what they're going to do as long as they're not opposed. And we have this wretched result there, which is just, I mean, these are real human being children being poisoned to death. It's horrifying to watch, and I think that this is a problem. So I hope the president will sort of step up to the mat here and do something beyond lobbing a few cruise missiles over there. I mean, this guy has to go, and we need to effectuate that in some fashion.
Is it hard? Some have suggested that it's really hard to figure out who the good guys are here, that who are fighting have become very closely identified with al-Qaeda. So what do you do about that?
Yeah, it is a real problem, and I have to say, you do need to be careful here that you're not replacing the deviler with the devil with the deviler,
mm-hmm.
Or the devilest, as it were. This is definitely a problem. One of the things that I think we have to understand is that we're never going to find, this applies not only to foreign policy, but domestic policy, we don't live and we cannot live and we'll never be able to have a utopian world. All choices are never perfect. What's the phrase about making the perfect the enemy of the good or the good whatever it is? We've got a situation here where people are dying in the streets, and I think something needs to be done about it. But again, if the United States is projecting its strength, even Al Qaeda would be a little warier as it goes about its business. Any enemy would be warier if they took us with a lot more seriousness than I think we are being taken at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Colin Powell's been talking a lot the last few days about several different topics, but I was listening to some of his comments this morning on Syria in which he said the U.S. simply can't get involved in all of the struggles in the world, can't get involved seriously in Syria. It essentially is an issue that has to be solved among people who live in Syria.
Well, for once, I agreed to some extent with General Powell. I haven't been agreeing with him on a lot lately. I do think that one of the differences between President Reagan and President Bush 43 is that President Reagan projected American strength, used it where necessary, did not want to get involved in what I guess we call in the popular phraseology nation building. It would be great if the whole world were democratic small d. The fact that it isn't is not something that should send us roaming the world, to use an old John Quincy Adams phrase, searching for monsters to destroy. The world is a very imperfect place. We cannot be everywhere at the same time. By the same token, we do have to be very careful in understanding that our primary interest is our own national security. And that should be one of the primary things that we're looking at. So I have to say, I think General Powell, and in this case he has the wisdom of being there both for the Gulf War in 1990 as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and as Secretary of State during the Iraq War situation. And I think we did the right thing in Iraq, but I think his point is well taken.
Mm-hmm. So when the president is looking at the possibilities here, who is he listening to and should be listening to in terms of international allies? And what do you see as something that would be successful in Syria, if there's anything?
Well, I think we have to find a way to get the president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad, out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to find a way to do that. That said, I don't know that we need necessarily to stick around and try and impose something on our own with all of this. Who is he listening to abroad? I frankly don't know. I mean, I think some of his compatriots over there are probably of like mind. Maybe others are not. I certainly think domestically he's probably taking a lot of advice from Secretary Kerry. I mean, John Kerry, and I certainly disagree with him a lot of things, but if you're President Obama, one of the reasons you made John Kerry Secretary of State is because he's, been in the U.S. Senate for, 28 years or whatever, and on the Foreign Relations Committee, and you pretty well agree on your worldview with John Kerry. So I assume he's listening to Senator Kerry, and then probably former Senator Hagel, Secretary of Defense Hagel,
mm-hmm.
as well. I'm not sure that their worldview is the best one, but I think that's where we're headed.
Mm.
President Obama's in the White House, so that's part of the discussion, and notably got there in the first place because he defeated Senator McCain, who had something of an alternative point of view on this.
Mm-hmm. And Senator Kerry is supposed to be giving a statement sometime, I think a press conference during this hour, so we have our eyes on that. Let's go to Egypt for a moment. My goodness, how things have changed in that country
in a short
period of time. Has the United States, do you think, been too wishy-washy in taking the generals to task for the violence?
Yeah, I think so. Again, I think this is a trademark. Not to get off on this tangent, which I promise you I won't, but I do think this is a trademark of modern American liberalism, and President Obama is a liberal, and so therefore I think this is what happens. I don't think there's any difference here essentially between President Obama dealing with Egypt and President Carter dealing with, you know, the Soviets or Iran or what have you in his day and age. So, yes, and I think that is the perception, and I think the Egyptians basically are looking at the president and blowing him off. I don't think that they, you know, they'll survive in all sorts of fashions here, which is not to say that I'm for the Muslim Brotherhood. I think that we made a severe mistake here in doing all this catering that has been done with the Muslim Brotherhood in the Obama administration. These people are essentially another version of Al-Qaeda, particularly in terms of their intellectual formation of the world and all this kind of thing. You read about the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood coming to America in the, whenever it was in the 20s or 30s and being appalled at what he saw as Western decadence, and then going back to Egypt and coming up with the Muslim Brotherhood and all of this. I mean, until we confront, you know, the very real world reality of what goes on in the world of Islam, we're always going to be beyond the eight ball here. In that sense, you have some sympathy for the generals. I think they're doing what they feel they've got to do to survive. But that said, once again, you don't run through the streets of Cairo and slaughter people. I mean, good Lord. I mean, this is horrendous.
Mm-hmm. Would you describe what the generals did as a coup, Jeffrey?
Sure. I mean, I think one of the things that we get into trouble with here is our use of the English language. This is a military takeover of the government. Now, it's not to say that the Muslim Brotherhoods were the best folks on earth. They did have an election. Now, the problem is that I think was very clear is they fall into the category of these people who believe in one election once, and that Egypt was rapidly heading down the road where there were not going to be any more elections. So, you know, I'm sympathetic to the idea that there are not a lot of great choices here. But to say, and of course the reason they don't want to say this is because I believe it's written into U.S. law that if there's a military takeover, there's a military coup, then we cut off aid. And I think they are very shy about getting into all of this kind of thing. But of course it was a coup. I mean, when the military throws out the democratically elected government, no matter what you think of that government, that is a coup by definition.
Which indicates that we should cut off all military aid?
Well, it indicates it at least in terms of current law. I mean, I have never understood why, with all of this turmoil over there, we don't use the big stick of our aid in the first place to sort of get this to a better place. But that, again, is not the way President Obama believes in doing business. And this goes to a larger foreign policy critique. I mean, I think to move to another area of the world, this is why Edward Snowden is over there in Russia feeling no heat, because Vladimir Putin looked the president right in the eye and basically said, too bad. And this was after a, quote-unquote, Hillary Clinton's first, quote-unquote, reset of relations with the Russians. Well, I think Vladimir Putin read the American president and decided he was no big deal and he could stick his finger in his eye at will and not, there would be no consequences. So he said to Mr. Snowden, you're here, that's fine with me, we'll go from there. And the White House is enraged, but I don't know that they can do anything about it.
We welcome phone calls. We'll move to more domestic areas as we continue our conversation. It's All Things Political here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jeffrey Lord is our guest, joining us from time to time. He is a contributing editor to the American Spectator and is a former aide to President Ronald Reagan and also to Jack Kemp. Here is our phone number if you'd like to comment on what the options are in Syria. We would like to hear from you on that, or on Egypt, or on Edward Snowden. Lots of people in Washington, D.C. over the weekend, and we'll talk about how various leaders are addressing the issue of race relations as we mark the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington this week. Jeffrey has written some very interesting pieces on the Republican Party and immigration. We will talk about that, dual citizenship, and more. Here's the number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, two phone calls for Jeffrey, and let's start with Willem in Colfax. Hi, Willem.
Hi. as far as the Egypt goes, you know, just cutting off aid to Egypt and in some sort of a knee-jerk reaction is, I think, it's much more complicated than that. The Egypt controls the Suez Canal, which controls shipping in the Mediterranean, the Persian Gulf, and basically everyone would have to go around Africa if it wasn't for the Suez Canal. So, plus the military contracts involve many U.S. jobs, so it's very complicated. And I think sometimes, like in the instance of Iraq, for instance, I think that's why the elder Bush didn't want to do that, but he didn't want to destabilize a country like Iraq for the reasons that what has happened now to Iraq, which I think has cost many, many lives, billions of dollars, and we have no good result. So you have to be really careful in these decisions.
Jeffrey.
Well, I think, first of all, in Iraq, I think Iraq is much better off now than it was under Saddam Hussein. And I think the country is a more, not the perhaps, but certainly a more stable place in terms of its effect on the Middle East than it would have been with Saddam Hussein there, who was perpetually scheming to get nuclear weapons, et cetera, chemical weapons, all of this. You know, I find it very interesting with this Syrian business. Where did these chemical weapons come from? I mean, I literally don't know the answer to that, but I would be curious as to how they got to Syria in the first place. We were told, of course, that there were chemical weapons in Iraq, in neighboring Iraq, and they weren't there. And there were some people at the time saying, well, they'd been shipped to Syria. I don't know that that's the case, but we do know now that they've got chemical weapons, and they used them. So I'd like to know how they got them. But it does seem to me, to go to Willem's question here, sometimes, you know, the simple answers are not, are frequently perceived as wrong because they're simple. It's not that they're simple, it's that they may be hard. When we get into this business of saying things are too complicated, for instance, President Reagan's approach to the Cold War was that famous phrase that, you know, we win, they lose. Well, this was anathema to people in the day who believed that, well, we had to have these endless complicated negotiations on arms control. It grew up a whole bureaucracy. The simple approach turned out to be the best one. And sometimes I think we have to look to that, and we might, you know, be thinking of doing that in Egypt as well.
Thanks, Willem, very much for your call. Let's go to Dave in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Dave.
Good afternoon, Kathleen, and to your guest also. I'm a supporter of President Obama, and like a lot of others, I'm not particularly happy with what's taking place in Egypt and in Syria and for that matter, even Afghanistan and Pakistan yet. But there are some bad choices to make, and there are some worse choices, and so I'm patient enough to know that it would be easy enough for us to get on the wrong side in Syria, and how do we know which side to be on in Egypt without it coming back to bite us, like at one time we supported the Mujahideen when they were shooting Russian helicopters out of the air in Pakistan. But I was struck by an irony in a comment of your guest about a military coup. Obviously, there was a military coup. There has been a military coup in Egypt by a military that pretty much has been supplied and trained in the United States over the years of both conservative, liberal, Republican, Democrat administrations. And if we look back to 1953, we could see the origin of much of our problem in the Middle East when we were involved in a military coup to overthrow the duly elected president of Iran, which eventually led to the takeover of our embassy and the imprisonment of those people. And I won't even mention the military coups that we've been involved in, or at least turned our heads the other way in South America. So we kind of end up, our chickens keep coming home to roost, and who brings more chickens home to roost? I don't know. Speaking of President Reagan, he presided over the death of a bunch of Marines over there because of the poor choices he was faced with. So.
All right, let's get a response from Jeffrey. Jeffrey.
Sure. Well, I think your caller has a point here. And let me say, speaking in terms of President Reagan, President Reagan decided as a result of that not to send in more troops, but to pull them out and not to make a stand in Lebanon, which I think he rightly saw as, you know, to put in the colloquial terms, Snake City. And there was no reason to you know, further embroil the United States in this. So out they came. He did not spend his time trying to nation build in Lebanon. I do think that the caller has a point. Certainly, I recall vividly as a kid learning of the coup when President Kennedy was in the White House against South Vietnam and President Ngo Dinh Diem. And, of course, that didn't end well at all for us. We wound up over there in a war which took until 1973 to get a peace treaty there under President Nixon. And then, of course, we stopped funding with the Congress and Vietnam fell, et cetera. So your caller has a point. I do think that we need to be more dedicated to the process of democracy. I will say in the defense of all of the presidents from Truman through Reagan in terms of the Cold War, that they saw the Soviet Union as the main problem in the world, and so they tried to figure out how to deal with it, and these military coups in different countries, you mentioned Iran, came about as part of that policy in terms of containing the Soviets. I'm not sure in retrospect it was the best policy, but that's, you know, second-guessing, Monday morning quarterbacking and all of that. As we go forward here, we do have another enemy out there in terms of the Islamic fundamentalists. I'm not sure that running around the world initiating coups is the best policy either.
What do you think has happened? I know this is a fairly big area and we've got a lot of territory here, but when you look at close allies and important countries like Egypt and what's happened since the president traveled to Cairo in 2009 and pledged a new beginning with the Arab world, and there was this great promise, and he saw promise, and everybody saw promise, and what happened to the promise? What's happened?
Right. Well, I was never a fan of that approach, and I think a lot of conservatives believed, again, that this went against the Reagan sort of doctrine, which I think Reagan's name gets attached to this, the peace through strength. But I think, frankly, this is the oldest of fundamental human relationships. When you're dealing with bullies anywhere, the neighborhood bully, you stand up to the bully, you make a stand, and you send out the message in one way or another that you're not going to tolerate this and that you have the capability to not tolerate it. That, in turn, without doing anything else, can help, you know, end a conflict. President Obama went over there, and his critics, myself included, began to call these things the apology tour. What he did is send a, and I don't think it was intentional on his part, but I think it was inevitable. He sent a message of weakness to various people over there, and so things have gone downhill since. And this is, I think, the oldest lesson in human relationships. And I think that there is a sort of willful blind spot on the part of American liberalism that just doesn't want to acknowledge this and thinks if we're just nice to folks, then these things won't happen. And unfortunately, what happens instead is that the bullies are encouraged and on they go.
Adib, thanks for the call. Joel in Appleton, hi.
Well, the thing is, economics have changed since the Reagan era. I mean, Reagan was able to achieve strength through deficit spending. That option just isn't there for us anymore. There's no way, many people in the country would stand for that, especially conservatives. I think what you're seeing is the result of the United States economically kind of declining some, getting hollowed out, and maybe, you know, the rest of the world kind of catching up, you know? And now we're witnessing what the effects of a multipolar power world, right? It's not just the East versus the West anymore. We're talking about regional power. And I think for the United States, you know, they get into trouble. Part of the trouble that they're in the Middle East is that they've supported strongmen who they had termed their, you know, their best option, their ally, that for decades suppressed democracies, suppressed liberal ideas, as well as people that we disagreed with. And, you know, it's the problem when you meddle in people's affairs constantly. eventually there's going to be an extreme backlash. I think we got to let them go through this process, blow each other up, as nasty as it is, but, you know, and then wait, you know, for a strong movement, like a democratic movement in Egypt, and then support that.
Jeffrey.
Well, your caller sounds like your basic right-wing Republican like me. I have to say, I think he's right. I think that we have, in many fashions here today, a hollowed-out United States, a hollowed-out economy. We're in bad shape, and there's reasons for this, but however we got here, which is a whole other question, we are here. And so, therefore, that does limit our ability and our capabilities around the world. I mean, there is, make no mistake about it, that one of the things that President Reagan had going for him is he took an economy that was going through terrible times, the greatest crisis since the Great Depression, and turned it around, did the things that conservatives believed, that Margaret Thatcher believed and was doing over in Great Britain, and they worked. 21 million jobs, it means a strong economy. And that's what you have to do anything. I mean, this applies in our own individual lives. Unless your own personal economy is straightened out and strong, your ability to go out and do the things that you want to do in the world or feel you should do are limited. And that applies to nations as well. So that is a very, very big part of this problem.
Thanks, Joel, for the call. Our number, as we continue our conversation on all things political with Jeffrey Lord, is 800-486-8655. And the email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Jeffrey is with us from time to time. He's a former aide to President Ronald Reagan and Jack Kemp. He's a contributing editor to The American Spectator. Let's talk a little bit about immigration and about what everybody's hearing from constituents as they enjoy the last week of summer and the last week of vacation. You wrote an interesting piece about immigration and Republican Party leaders doing battle with the party's base over this very issue, which strikes me as an important issue in the midterm elections coming up and in the presidential election. What's the battle? What's the way to go to win votes for the Republican Party?
I think one of the larger things that we should be doing, and this goes right from immigration to this March on Washington, I think that one of the problems we have in America is that good ideas and good ideals of having, you know, Dr. King's view of a colorblind society where people are judged not by skin color but by the content of their character, frankly, has been lost. And I think the immigration issue has become polarized partially because of that, because I think there are people who want to push this as a racial issue, you know, that we've got all these brown would-be Americans and we're being unfair to them. The point that I made in my column was that this is a country that is, as President Reagan liked to say, you can go to England but you'd never be an Englishman, or you could move to France and you'd never be French. That's because every other country in the world is based on nationality, ethnic identity.
Mm-hmm.
This is the only country in the world based on an idea, ideas of freedom and liberty and so forth. So when we get into situations like that, we should realize that this, everybody in this country, 100% of the United States of America, of our population, is either an immigrant or an ancestor, or their ancestors were immigrants. There are no other kind of people in this country. So to say that we are, you know, anti-immigrant by opposing or by favoring, say, closing the border or securing the border in the South, or and doing things of that nature and saying that we're opposed to amnesty, all we're saying is, really, we just want legal immigrants in America. That's it. Nobody is saying, don't come to America if you're of Mexican descent or Colombian or South American descent somewhere in South America. Don't be saying, that's not what we're saying. What we're saying is we just believe in an orderly process where people come, they apply for status, and then after a certain amount of time, they are able to come in and become American citizens.
And the people who are here already?
And the people who are here already, I think we should have a guest visitor status, and then they need to get to the end of the line. I mean, I'm very wary of all these cliches about a quote-unquote path to citizenship, because when you look at them, the path is not as difficult as it is made to, you know, it's not at all difficult. It's, well, you know, if this happens or that happens, you know, you check this and then in you go. Meanwhile, you've got somebody who's come from some other country and they've done all the right things, and they're sitting here waiting patiently, and they're not going to make anywhere near as much progress as the person who sneaks over the border in the dead of night, you know, into Texas or Arizona. I mean, that's the problem, and it also results in, you know, a disrespect for the law. And, of course, that's not good either.
And politically, what do you think works best for the Republican Party in terms of winning votes, midterm or next presidential, Jeffrey?
They need to stick with the, you know, the principles. I think Dr. King, when you go back, and I took a look the other day, and I have to say, I'm dating myself here, but I remember this speech. I was a kid watching this in Massachusetts on television, black and white television, I might add. And it was a tremendous speech. And you mm-hmm. would think today that that these words were uttered by, if you didn't know, were uttered by Ronald Reagan or uttered by Ted Cruz. I mean, or Rush Limbaugh, for that matter. Here is a speech that is filled with references to the Declaration of Independence and America and America's heritage and America's history and how he believes in a colorblind America where we're all judged by the content of our character. What this has become, most unfortunately, is identity politics, which is basically a first cousin to the racial politics that the Democratic Party used for all of its existence, you know, supporting slavery, supporting segregation, lynching. Now it's into, you know, racial quotas or, you know, telling people, well, because you're brown, we want you to come over the border and, you know, it's all about race. This is the wrong way to go. And I think that the Republican Party has to have a very clear and consistent message, which has been out there from Republican presidents, from Reagan, all the way back to Abraham Lincoln, and just stick to that. And if we're going to lose votes because of it, then we lose votes. But for the country's sake, we have to be crystal clear on this and make sure that we want a country where everybody is judged by the content of their character, and we don't care what you look like, what your sexual preference is, whether you're, what your gender is, what your race is, that all of that is irrelevant to the content of your character. Hmm. I mean, the content of your character is the main thing.
You really think Rush Limbaugh could have given that speech and agreed with everything that Martin Luther King...
Absolutely.
Really?
To Rush. I know Rush by email. We go back and forth on occasion, and I listen to him all the time, and he has said some version of this repeatedly over the years. So has Sean Hannity, so in the World of Talk Radio, so has my friend Mark Levin said these kind of things. I mean, this is exactly what they talk about on air. I mean, I just find it remarkable that today, in terms of the content of that speech that Dr. King gave, he would be considered today a right-winger. And I just find that, so too, for that matter, with President Kennedy. I just find it remarkable.
A right-winger.
I might add that you know, these views were sort of formative for me as a kid. And I haven't changed a bit on them. I mean, I still believe them. And I just find, you know, I'm just always astounded to see where this has gone, because I think it's a terrible thing for the country.
Well, let's talk about some of what was discussed on the Mall this weekend and what Colin Powell has been saying and people's concerns with voting and what the Supreme Court had to say and how Congress might respond to that and whether or not it will keep people of color from voting and what Colin Powell had to say about the jury decision in the Trayvon Martin case.
Sure. I think, first of all, you know, you touched on voting and voter ID. We have a law here that's still, I think, going through the court process in Pennsylvania for voter ID. We have to, in our society today, for a variety of reasons, some of which we've touched on tangentially here in terms of terrorism, we have to use photo IDs for just about everything you can imagine, whether you're buying a bottle of wine at a store if you're underage, whether you're getting cold medicine, whether you're trying to get on an airplane. I mean, there's 1,001 different things that we have to have this for. If people do not have access to a free photo ID, then the county that they live in should supply it to them. They should be able to get this. But there is no question. I looked at the election in 2008 in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and I found, and I wrote about this at the time, as a matter of fact, in the run-up to the election, there were photographs that I was able to find of pieces of property in Philadelphia that were listed as voting addresses, and they were empty lots or vacant houses. There was nobody there, not a soul, and yet there were people listed as voting from there. This kind of thing happens all the time in America. And because it is so hard for people to, you know, nobody wants to go around and do the proper investigation work on this. They say, oh, well, there's no problem. There is a problem. As long as when I was first coming up in the world of Pennsylvania politics, this was a big deal back then. I heard Chris Matthews say quite some time ago, and he's from Philadelphia, that he knew that there was a big problem with voter fraud. All we're trying to do is make sure that the voting process, which protects for everyone, Black Americans included. There was an incident down in Maryland, in suburban Washington, where somebody stolen into the voting place of Eric Holder, who is, of course, the sitting Attorney General of the United States, and said, "Hi, I'm Eric Holder. I'm here to vote." They went down a list of names. They said, I mean, obviously this person who was sitting behind the desk had no idea who Eric Holder was. They looked down, found his name, and said, "Oh, yes, Mr. Holder, here's your card." And then the guy said, "Oh, well, do you need an ID?" And he said, no. He says, "Well, let me go out to the car." Of course, he wasn't actually going to commit voter fraud, so he went out and he didn't come back. The point is, here is somebody who was going to let somebody vote in the name of the Attorney General of the United States. And I can only imagine Eric Holder's surprise had that happened, and he showed up to vote in his own precinct, and somebody said, "Well, Mr. Holder, you're recorded as already having voted." I mean, this is just crazy here.
But Jeffrey, I hear what you're saying, and yet, if indeed voter fraud is as widespread as you say it is, I would have thought there would have been expose after expose and prosecutions taking place all over the country.
There have been exposés. There have not been prosecutions.
Well, why?
Well, good question. I think that's a very good question. I think that there is an interest in not pursuing this. I will say that. I watched a Fox News report on this, and here was a woman in the Cleveland area. She not only voted for herself, she voted for her relatives. She voted, according as I recall the story, at least six times for five other people other than herself. And she, by the way, was a voting official, as I recall this, a local voting official. And she was quite happy. She didn't think she did anything wrong. She thought she knew how they were going to vote, so she voted for him. This is the problem. And prosecuting these folks, I mean, let's face it, if you want to run for office in, let's say, Philadelphia, and you want to go to your base and say, "Hey, I want to make sure that we all know who you are," you're going to, the way this issue is presented all the time, which is as a racial issue, you're going to stir up opposition and animosity. And I think that's, again, why when we get into this identity politics, this is a bad thing. And it's been going on for centuries here. This is only the latest name for it. And I think it has to be stopped.
All right. Well, if you want to send me all the information you've done, I just have yet to see anything that's very indicative that this is a huge problem in this country. So I'm willing to look at what you got. But let's pause for a moment, which we need to do, and welcome more phone calls. You are listening to All Things Political here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And our guest this hour is Jeffrey Lord. Jeffrey is contributing editor to the American Spectator, former aide to President Ronald Reagan, and also to Jack Kemp. Did I give you the number? You know, you do it so often. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to phone calls. Reed in Clintonville. Hi.
Yes, hi. First, let me thank you for the opportunity to speak here. I'm just absolutely stunned by the comments by your guest. It's a sort of tea publican rhetoric that we hear day after day after day with no substantial support to back up anything they say. They throw out all these red meat, hot button issue items and yet can never support and prove any of them.
What issues are of concern to you, Reed?
Disappointing.
What are you concerned about? What issues are you concerned about?
My issue that I'm concerned about is because of so much of this, and it's so racial and blatantly so, starting right at the top with our president, that we are now seeing individuals who are of color, black, brown, whatever, being bleached. And if you're not familiar with it, it's starting to happen, and it just happened again recently in Texas, where balloons are filled instead of with water with bleach, and persons of color are being hit with these balloons. And this stems from all of the hateful, racist rhetoric that the Tea Publicans have spewed and espoused for decades.
Thanks. Jeffrey, all right, thanks for the call. Jeffrey.
Well, sure, two things. Number one is the Democratic Party that supported slavery, segregation, lynching. They now support racial quotas, illegal immigration, all of it based on race. And the Republican Party, which ended slavery, which opposed segregation, which desegregated under Richard Nixon, the public schools of this country, the Republican Party, which has is filled with people like my friend Deneen Borelli and all of these conservative folks who happen to be black, they're the folks. It's very interesting. And when you talk with these people, and I've been on the Hannity show with these folks, and Sean has had two different specials filled with people who are black conservative Americans. And they're the ones who are saying that, your side is, in fact, the one doing this. And they're fed up with it. A woman by the name of Star Parker said that this was the same plantation treatment. I'm quoting her now. The same plantation treatment dealt out by Southern slave owners when slavery was still in effect, and that they, black conservatives, are being subjected to this by liberal Americans. And Dr. Ben Carson, whom I was also on the show with, said that liberal, and I'm quoting him, that liberal white Americans, liberal Americans are among the most racist folks out there. That was his quote, not mine. So I would just respectfully suggest to the gentleman that to say that we believe in a colorblind America where one's color doesn't matter is not a racist statement.
Let's go next to Dave in Blue Mounds. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Three real quick points about chemical weapons. First, your guest is apparently unaware that Syria isn't a member of the Chemical Weapons Treaty and is known to have chemical weapons. Second, the issue about a possible transfer of chemical weapons from Iraq to Syria was debunked by two different CIA groups during the Bush administration. And finally, it makes very little sense that Syria would be using chemical weapons right now, given that a UN inspector group was in the country at the time.
So what do you think you're seeing? What are those images?
Well, I'm not denying that there's chemical weapons use. I'm just saying that to jump to the conclusion that it's the Syrian government is premature.
Yeah, I know it's been entertained that maybe it's some other force, that those have been planted somehow. Do you adhere to that at all or entertain that thought, Jeffrey?
At this point, I have to believe it's the Syrian government. I'm open to see where the evidence is, and we just learned today that the United Nations has been over there, and they have been shot at and lost a vehicle. And there's thankfully no lives, but they lost a vehicle in trying to get to the bottom of some of this. So I think it's very important that we get to the bottom. I mean, the fact, I would again say that this notion that because somebody belongs or doesn't belong to a particular treaty is going to stop bad people from doing bad things is just a little bit short of, with all due respect, crazy. I mean, this is the same notion that Neville Chamberlain had, and he came back to Great Britain after talking with Adolf Hitler, and, you know, there's all these old newsreel photos of him waving a piece of paper as if that was it, that Hitler had promised not to do A, B, and C, and, of course, Hitler could have cared less and went on, as we know, to do all the rest that he did. So again, just basic human nature. This is a family, the Assad family, the president of Syria's family. As I recall, his father took some opposition villages and turned them into parking lots, literally, in some cases. So we've got people here who have very ugly dispositions. They are bullies, and I think we have to be very, very careful here about all of this and just not assume anything.
Another Dave, this one in Wanakee. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, hi. I disagree with your guest about what we should do in the Middle East. And the reason for that is I think we have a bad track record in regard to interfering in the Civil War. Because I remember during the 1980s that there was a Civil War going on in Lebanon, and there was a president who decided to put 240 Marines in the middle of Beirut. And then he decided to side with the Christian phalanges and decided to have the Navy start shelling the opposition. The opposition's response was to launch a suicide bombing attack in which 240 Marines got killed. After that, of course, we all forgot it because for some reason, Grenada became much more important than that. Could you please talk about the president's thinking on that?
All right, let's get to the answer.
Sure, I think President Reagan, and I think President Reagan would say he made a mistake in Lebanon. He did not make a mistake in Grenada. And if you'll recall, there was a lot of criticism at the president of the president at the time for sending troops to Grenada. And when that whole sort of view of things changed, when American kids from the medical school down there who were rescued got off the plane, knelt on the ground, and kissed the ground of the United States, and suddenly people started backing off and realized that President Reagan did the right thing. So in the one case, he made a mistake. He didn't make the mistake, and he didn't, unlike JFK and LBJ, he didn't keep sending troops to Lebanon and make this a major deal. He stopped, and the troops came home. In Grenada, he went there, he won a decisive situation, and the people he rescued were deeply pleased that he did and owe their lives to him, and they've said so many times.
Thank you, Dave, for your call. Frank in Sheboygan, hi.
Hello. I'm calling in response to the example of Eric Holder going to the voting place and possibly being denied the right to vote. In America, the issue is one man or woman, one vote. If Eric Holder had been confronted under different circumstances, he could have said, no, I haven't voted. Look at my index finger. There's no purple ink. Remember, in Iraq, when the elections were held, the voters were required to dip their finger in purple ink, an indelible ink that would last the entire day and perhaps several days.
Mm-hmm.
The issue is not whether you are voting in somebody else's name. The issue is whether you get to vote more than once, because the person who impersonated Eric Holder in that theoretical situation got to vote once.
All right, Jeffrey.
Well, I mean, obviously we have to know who was. If Eric Holder shows up and he's not famous and says, I'm Eric Holder, and they just let him vote, and then it turns out that it's not Eric Holder, that's the problem that we're discussing here. I mean, I'm all for, if you want to have, people dip their fingers in ink. As a matter of fact, when we vote here in Pennsylvania, we get handed a little sticker that says, I voted, which, you put on or throw away, do whatever you want with. But the point is, we have to know that Eric Holder is Eric Holder when he shows up, that Jeffrey Lord is Jeffrey Lord when he shows up to vote. And this is a very easy thing to do. We can have individual counties go out to voters. Good Lord, they get Social Security. They get everything else that they get in life, and we get in life, with an ID, with a picture ID. So this is not as complicated here. And frankly, it's going to protect a lot of African Americans and protect everybody's right to vote.
What did you think? Another issue that came up over the weekend, and will, of course, is speeches continue on the mall, was the jury verdict in the Trayvon Martin case, which has brought to the forefront issues of race again. What did you think of that verdict, Jeffrey?
Well, first of all, I thought it was a terribly sad situation. In listening to this, I didn't see any evidence of race in it. I mean, and I listened. I mean, I'm very sensitive on this because my family went through some situations when we lived in the South, and we were very strongly civil rights oriented, and my dad lost his job a couple times for standing up for African Americans. So I do have a particular sensitivity on it. I didn't hear it in this trial, I just think it's a tragedy. I think that one guy misread the other. Somebody at the American Spectator, not myself, wrote a column that said, I think it was titled, Two Males, No Men, basically meaning that you had two guys, one of whom is Hispanic and one of whom is African-American, and they got into this sort of, tough guy mentality that people who are not fully emotionally formed can do, and they got into trouble because of it, and somebody wound up dying because of it, and I think it's a tragedy, but I don't think it was racist. When you listen to all of the conversations on the tapes and all of this sort of thing, the tape that was altered by NBC News, where it's made to appear that George Zimmerman is asked, was saying the guy is black, when in fact it was the police officer who said, what color is he? What does he look like? And then he says, in response to this, and here's a guy, Zimmerman, and he's no hero by any stretch of the imagination, but in his personal life, he mentored black kids, took them into his home when the money, however he was being paid, got cut off. He did it himself, dated a black girl. I mean, this was not a prejudiced man in that sense of the word.
Jeffrey, we're out of time.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Happy end of summer. All right,
okay,
Jeffrey,
you
thanks.
Too. Bye-bye.
Jeffrey Lord, contributing editor of the American Spectator, former aide to President Ronald Reagan and also to Jack Kemp. We'll hear more about this on the news, I'm sure, but we told you we'd keep track of Secretary of State Kerry. He is talking about Syria. What is before us is real. It is compelling. We have additional information that is being reviewed, so that story will continue to develop this hour. Thanks to KP Whaley and Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour.